Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome everybody to this edition of Edgy Ideas podcast. I'm delighted to have a colleague, a friend, Richard Morgan Jones as my guest. Richard is a distinguished member of ISPSO. He's a visiting professor at the Indian Institute of Management and at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. Richard works as an organizational consultant, a coach. He's a group relations practitioner, and he's an author. Richard, you're very welcome to Edge Ideas. How are you feeling today?
I'm good, thank you, Simon. Thank you for inviting me.
Good. Well, we've got lots to talk about. Let's start with your book, The Body of the Organization and Its Health. It's an unusual title. Can you say a bit about what led you to write that book? Let's start there.
Yes, of course. I've had two main professions, in a way, and practices. The one has been organizational development work, practicing as a consultant and a coach, and also doing group relations. The other is a clinical practice. I was trained in initially group therapy, community therapy, which is where I started my life in a therapeutic community, as I believe you did.
Correct.
And yeah. I also trained as an individual, a family psychotherapist, and then an individual psychotherapist, and up my game so that I was working intensively in psychoanalysis with a couch and working four and five times a week with people. And I think what started me to think about the body in relation to psychoanalysis and organizations was that both in my clinical work as well as in consultancy assignments, a large number of people were struggling about how to manage the sick role. Given the experience that GPs, no general practitioners, medical practitioners, no longer wanted to determine whether people were sick or not, people were self-certificating. There were new regimes, certainly in the UK and in a lot of other countries too. And in consequence, managers had the dilemma of how to manage people who'd gone off sick. And people themselves were in a dilemma. People who were in senior partnerships were in a dilemma. So I started getting curious about what it was about the dynamics of not just psychosomatic illness, but what I came to call sociosomatic illness. In other words, the way in which people had obviously personal physical vulnerabilities, but also were vulnerable to the dynamics and strains and stresses of the organization. So that's really where it began, out of a number of work assignments.
Yes, and this is for us in the system psychodynamic field, we sort of take this way of thinking for granted, but it's actually quite unusual, isn't it, to think about how a system, how an organization can act out its dysfunction on individuals, on teams, rather than the other way around. We usually kind of individualize sickness, don't we, and say, you know, so-and-so is sick because of this reason, without taking into that systemic account of it. And that's what you're focusing on, isn't it?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I was very struck by the practice, and I interviewed a good number of people who are working in the occupational health field. And of course, their job was to try and get people back to work. It was a bit like the dilemma faced by psychiatric institutions in the First and the Second World War, the Craig Lockhart experiment in the First World War, the Northfield experiment in the Second World War. The dilemma for psychiatrists was, if men returned to the front because they had recovered from the shell shock that had taken them to the hospital, they were putting themselves at risk, A, of more mental illness and stress, and B, of dying. Yes. So it was a moral dilemma.
Yeah.
Now, I think occupational health departments were dealing with the thing exactly as you say. I think you've put your finger on it, as if the problem was the individual. And government in the UK and in other countries but also the HR profession, spent a fortune on how to manage people in the process of returning to work, but giving them the responsibility. Yeah. My hypothesis turned the whole thing on its head. My hypothesis was that actually information about why people were going sick had an epidemic aspect of it. So it was a public health issue and needed to be brought to the attention of the organizations where people worked.
Yeah, yeah. I'm working in the humanitarian sector at the moment, and we've done some workshops on trauma, and it's quite interesting because when you're dealing with warfare, with crisis, with famine, with this very frontline kind of a tough experience, you get off sick with post-traumatic stress disorder. You know,
I bet.
Again, it becomes individualized, you know, but, you know, my question has been in these sectors, can what happens to trauma across the system? Who holds it on behalf of whom?
It's a spot-on question. Spot-on question. Who holds it on behalf of whom, and who holds it on behalf of what? Yes. I mean, I think one of the hypotheses I came to later, and it was a kind of hypothesis, not just that you could deliver as a piece of insight, but that you could work with. The way I approached it was to understand that if you followed, actually, it's a clue in Bion's experiences in groups. He suggests that if you want to understand what causes group diseases, you have to look at statistics. Now, most people who think who read experiences in groups don't read that little bit, nor the fact that he puts in the preface that he's going to write a book one day all about occupational health. Mm-hmm. So, if you like, that's one of the sources of my authority. Of doing this particular investigation. Now, I think one of the ideas, the key ideas, is really that the strategic risk taken by the organization and the kind of people who are attracted to the profession create what our good friend Philip Boxer describes as the risk of a Faustian pact. Mm-hmm. Whereby the kind of people who are attracted to working in the front line in the kind of organizations you've been working with, where people are full of the risk of being traumatized, are people who have in their background experience necessarily some experience of trauma, physical, violent, psychological, sexual. And by working vicariously with it, they get some sense of containment. So it's an occupational risk hazard.
Yes. Yeah. We call it valency in the trade. People are drawn into these professions because they have a previous kind of history of trauma or of experiencing something, and they either want to make reparation to that, or they want to contain their own experience of it, isn't it?
That's the one. But what are you finding with these organizations, with these frontline humanitarian rescue organizations?
Well, I'm finding that there's a lot of work to do in this area. I'm finding that, you know, there's they're kind of value driven organizations, but like any large organizations, there's a lot of bureaucracy and there's a lot of frustration in the organizations where you join the organization because you're very value driven, you have some valency to the work, you know, you have some emotional attachment to the work, and yet you're blocked by bureaucracy to either doing the work, or you're thrown into the front line and you're doing some good work, and yet there's not a systemic outlet for expressing the trauma you're carrying on behalf of others. You know, so your two choices are carry on or go off sick.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's not a third choice of working it in the system. So that's what we're trying to do, is trying to work it in the system and trying to understand it better.
Interesting.
As a systemic force, yeah.
What do you have a particular thought at the moment about, as a result of your investigation so far, about what it is that might make a difference? What kind of intervention?
Well, we're trying to use my eco-leadership methodology. So we're trying to really think about kind of the ecosystem and think about the humanitarian sector as a kind of an ecosystem within another ecosystem. So what is it which keeps an ecosystem healthy? What is it keeps an ecosystem? How can you nurture an ecosystem? So we're trying to build an ecosystemic response, and that's a multiple response, a plural response. It will be creating spaces for containment, spaces for development.
Different levels.
Yeah, at all different levels, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's
I think that's where my work has taken me. I was always very much taken with Kurt Lewin's ideas about force field analysis. So you look at the forces for change, the forces against change, and you try and make a map. But I think it's more complicated than that. I've developed an approach to that sort of analysis and that sort of engagement, really, which is called the trilogy event that you and I have talked about before. It's a way of in a representation of an organization in three concentric circles. The circles work one at a time. The first circle, the inner circle, if you like, focuses on the person. The second circle focuses after that, after they've worked for about 20 minutes or so, on the group dynamics. And the third circle, well, again, works separately, having observed the other two, on the dynamics inflicted and got under the skin, if you like, of the other two circles from the context. So it obviously includes political, cultural issues, linguistic issues, and a whole range of organizational tasks and survival issues, which are very important to analyze at the same time.
Yeah, I joined you on one of your trilogy events in London. It was very powerful, and maybe we can bring it into the sector, because it's like in my leadership and coaching work, we work from like a depth analysis, that individual space, kind of what's going on in the individual, connecting it to kind of relational analysis, how you relate to the teams, the groups, and then that kind of wider social perspective. And these things are entangled, aren't they? There's an entanglement here, which often gets missed.
That's a good word, entanglement. I think that's right. I think potentially it's the kind of entanglement which in the current climate creates a kind of mad-driving catch-22 situation where you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. Finding a middle ground is really stressful. And I say catch-22 because that's really a throwback to the psychiatric dilemma for the pilot in the original story of Catch-22, Joseph Heller's brilliant book, that the pilots who had done 22 missions were able to complete their work and go on to other assignments. If they extended their missions, it could have terrible, stressful effects on them, potentially driving them mad. Yeah, if they went to the doctor who said they were mad, then they didn't have to go. They were sick. But if they went to the doctor and said they were sick, then they're in a position where, because they'd gone to the doctor, they weren't mad. So they had to fly the missions. Completely mad driving. And there are so many situations that we're in today, not least as a result of propaganda, which embody the idea which came up, I think, from the Second World War of menticide. That Nazi propaganda was so powerful in occupied societies that people were mad if they didn't cooperate, and yet they were mad if they didn't resist.
This, you mentioned getting under the skin before. You have a way of thinking about the skin. Say something about that from a psychodynamic perspective.
Yes, yes, I will. Where to begin? You see, the phrase in psychodynamics, which seems to me to be describe the culture of a lot of psychoanalytic thinking, is the idea of getting under the surface to find out what's going on at depth. It's a Western model that belongs very much to the idea that actually our conscious mind denies our animal mind. We need an act of the will and elements of insight, which we come to through a good psychoanalysis, group relations experience, and so on, in order to be able manage ourselves so that the animal, ruthless side of ourselves, oral, anal, and genital, to follow Freud, doesn't take over. Yeah. I have to say, I think it's a rather perverse model. And what interested me about the work, particularly of Didier Anzieux, a Frenchman, in his work with groups and individuals, was the idea that the primary ego, as Freud said, is a skin ego, and it's a surface. And the projection of the ego on the surface of the skin is actually the key way in which people relate. So by looking at skin relations, you look at the impact of people on other people's skins and vice versa. So the focus of analysis is on the skin level, not underneath it.
Yeah.
Now, we can think about people with thick skins and thin skins. And I think it's a very interesting way of examining not just primary narcissism and secondary narcissism, but also the way in which groups and organizations function. But I think, for example, if you take an Eastern view, where the primary model is not about the body being the enemy of the mind, to be controlled in some way. And if you take, for example, one of the many spiritual practices, and there are many from the East, but yoga is one of them and a very common one, the practice of breathing is a far more primitive aspect of interrelationship than Freud's analysis of the oral, anal, and genital. Yeah. In psychoanalysis, I know of only two authors who've really analyzed the experience of breathing. One is Marion Milner, who is a colleague of Donald Winnicott. The other is Michael Eigen from the States. They've written very little about it, but I think what they do write is very telling, because, of course, the word, the Greek word for breath is psyche, which translates into the way in which people describe the experience of the mind. In spiritual terms, we think of it as of spirit, and of course we use the breathing metaphor, breathing in and breathing out. Yeah. I mean, maybe that leads us into something of your own interest in matters of spiritual.
Yeah, it's I mean, I'm just to stay on the skin and the body for a moment, I've just finished a sentence in a paper I'm writing, and I talk about the body speaks and the unconscious speaks, and it's almost as one. To me, these things are so, you know, your body is the unconscious in many ways. It's not this kind of like a iceberg with kind of something in your brain where a part of it's kind of just dormant and then gets released. It's actually your body carries our unconscious feelings, our skin does, as you say. So I think that's very important. I mean, getting onto the spiritual, I mean, I'm finding it very, very interesting to work. I just been talking to somebody about soul guide coaching, and it's really drawing on a long tradition of when I wrote my book on coaching, I really thought about kind of this new fad called coaching. It isn't really that new. You know, if you think about spiritual direction, going back into monasteries, you go back to spiritual friendship. In the Christian tradition, you know, which I'm more familiar with, and then there's all the Eastern traditions and other traditions, but there's this long tradition of kind of a one-to-one helping relationships, through which aren't just friendship; they're kind of friendship plus something extra, so it's spiritual direction. And I think that is absolutely central to the work. You know, whether I'm working in a car manufacturer or a tech company, there's a thirst for the spiritual kind of world. There's a thirst for transcendental, something beyond the material world, which people feel entrapped in. So for me, we live in a disenchanted world. There's a lot of disenchantment out there. People are quite troubled and struggling to kind of find a language, which is perhaps not a religious language, but a way of expressing something beyond the material kind of a consumerist kind of experience most of us have. So I try and work with it in my work whilst being very wary of kind of new agey spiritual fads whilst being wary of stepping into kind of a religious dogma is a difficult path, but I think a very important one.
I think you're right, Simon. I mean, I think what interests me in what you say is your link between that and the notion of the culture in an organization. Because a lot of the early pioneers at the Tavistock were very concerned in the post-war years in the UK, getting engaged in projects, industrial not least, communitarian as well, that would improve people's sense of morale after the war. It was a hangover from the war, which required spirit, courage, commitment. I mean, one of the most interesting writers, I think, in that particular field is a very interesting, well, he was a Quaker as well as a psychiatrist. He was very clearly Wilfred Bion's mentor, John Rickman.
Yes.
Who actually started his community work as a doctor in the steppes of Russia, which is a fact that's not often recognized during the time of the revolution in 1917. Yeah. It's a very interesting story to go into. Come back to my question. What's your experience of how to make links between the desire for the transcendent and people struggling with, and if you like, suffering existing cultures inside organizations?
I mean, my experience of it is that you open a door and you, like in my coaching work and consulting work, I let people know that I have this part of myself, which is part of Simon Western, and I bring it into nearly all my work as a background. I think if you go in as a foreground and say, I'm going to run a workshop on spirituality, or I'm going to bring kind of spirituality to the fore, it attracts a certain group of people. It attracts other people who are kind of more ambiguous or vulnerable or not kind of so sure. I just kind of hold it there as a space to work with, as an open door, and I'm quite amazed how many people walk through that door and want to do some work in that space.
Yes. Do you connect it in any way to the experience of dreaming?
No, because dreaming is problematic for me in the sense that I don't remember many dreams. I'm not very good at work. We all have different skill sets and different kind of ways of working. I think social dream matrices are very important, but I don't find them easy. I don't find them easy to engage in. So dreaming is just something I've just not been very drawn or skilled at working with.
Yes.
But I'm sure that is a way in. I'm sure it's one of the ways.
I mention it because one of When I was training as a psychotherapist, one of our teachers was a young analyst called Kit Bolas, Christopher Bolas, whose writings are quite well known. And he ran a seminar on dreams, and he told us all about the traditional Freudian methodology. You know, when a patient brings a dream, you ask for associations, and then you make links and connections, hopefully with the patient, and produce, if you like, some kind of interpretation, which may or may not include a transference. What Christopher Bolas suggested was a very different approach. He suggested that we treat each dream experientially. Mm-hmm. In other words, you don't look for associations. You start with some version of, goodness me, you woke and found you had a dream. Or was it that the dream had you?
Yeah.
So people get a chance to actually, before they start getting into heavy psychoanalytic work, they do some experiential work around what it's like to be awakened. And the waking experience is accompanied by a dream.
Yeah.
And the reason why I think that's very important is because I think in the kind of psychoanalysis that I've been engaged in, what matters is not the interpretation that provides a containment of what some people call understanding or insight, What matters is the capacity of the individual, the group, or the organization to build a container so that when you finish working with them, they go on doing that work.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like what a childhood doctor of mine once described as opening medicine when you get constipated. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a way of opening up the innards.
Yes, yeah. And I think this is very important. I mean, in my work, I'm always thinking of this parallel process that you're not just containing people so that they can actually express something in the here and now. You're actually trying to help them learn how to build containers to take back into their workplace. I mean, you're talking about dreams. One area really does interest me is the Indigenous and First Nations people, and that's getting closer to Chris Bowlis's work, I think. I'm working with a colleague called Michelle McMahon. She's Australian First Nations, and very, very interesting around the connectivity and the interdependence of material and non-material world, of the animated world around us, of the dream world. And the way they work with it is just so interesting. We realize it kind of shines a light back on us to think just how stuck we are with these modern mindsets, with these kind of very hyper-rational. Even in psychoanalysis, we try and have our scientific meetings and we try and use a language which is very kind of object relations. It's very kind of, structural. Theirs is a much more organic language, a much more kind of blurred boundaries, much more fluid. Very interesting, I think.
I was very taken by a recent experience working with Jerry Fromm around a workshop we've developed around, following his book, his brilliant book, How Trauma Travels Through Time. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of people from Australia, one from representative of Indigenous groups in New Zealand as well. And the thing which struck me particularly was the respect that these people have learnt for the sense of land and origins and where we came from. Yeah. And I just think it's a very important dimension. So they in introducing themselves, they give thanks to the people who have worked the land and lived the land where they are.
Yeah. One of the interesting, mixing this up with spirituality, one of the interesting experiences I had is the First Nations people, like ancestors are a big part of their you know, the Indeed. Ancestors with them in the here and now. It's not just something of the past. When I was in a monastery, a Benedictine monastery, I spent quite a bit of time in monasteries, which has been very special, kind of important place for me over the years. And once I was in a Benedictine monastery and I was really taken that the prayers were being said for this brother and that brother and this person who was sick. And then the person saying the prayers just dropped in, and I'd like to pray for Brother Michael, who died in 1327. Mm. And it was this kind of moment of kind of a awakening for me that, wow, you know, this kind of the eternal time, the way we're so fixed in our current kind of moment in time in the Western mindset. And yet in a monastery, it's much more expansive. In the First Nations way of thinking, it's much more expansive. How we can kind of transcend this.
Indeed. I mean, let me make a leap. I think you could read the average psychoanalytic text in terms of it being an ancestor cult.
Yes,
Ron Britton, for example, a Kleinian analyst, has written a very interesting paper on the pressures on people when they're presenting and publishing papers to quote the right people. And if that's not an ancestor cult, what is it?
Yeah, no, it's very alive today. The fights between the tribes and the
mine's better than yours all the time.
Exactly. And in there, you know, I've been studying Lacan quite a bit, as you know, and already, like, Lacan's very contemporary, and yet there's about four different schools fighting each other already, like within the Lacanian tradition, you know.
I imagine.
Who you follow, this guru or that one, it's very endemic in our system.
Absolutely. No, every self-respecting psychoanalytic institute is split and torn asunder, isn't it? It's vicious.
You began, I don't know where you began, but I remember you telling me that you were in theological college.
Yes, I was. Well, yeah. Began is an interesting word.
Yes, yeah.
I began a lot before then, but
that was a path you chose to take. Tell us a bit about that and how that links to kind of your work or doesn't link.
Well, it's a good question. In fact, my early career began before that. Mm-hmm. In that, coming from a pretty well-to-do and fairly wealthy upper middle class family, with all its advantages and disadvantages, and plenty of privileges, being a white male out there in the world in the top 5 or 10% of the population of as far as income and education is concerned. I had the experience of briefly going to boarding school until I protested to my parents about the punishment beatings and the cruelty, which seem a very bizarre way for people to spend their money, sending their children to schools which had so much cruelty. Yeah. There was also a lot of kindness in those contexts, not least from members of staff who weren't caught up in that paramilitary regime. Mm-hmm. Something to survive, anyway. So when I was 16 and living at home and going to school every day, and I was very much into my sport and playing a lot of rugby and cricket and rowing and so on, in teams, which is another dimension of coaching we could get into. Mm-hmm. But one day, looking at the sports notice board, a little notice went up saying, "Do you want to join a group investigating its own dynamics?" I signed up. We met once a week across the school year. It was by someone trained in the Tavistock method, trained by a woman who was a teacher called Elizabeth Richardson, whose works are sadly out of print now. So at the age of 17, if people asked me what I wanted to do for my career, I'd say, "I'm going to work with groups." And they would say, "Well, that's not a career." And I said, "No, but it's going to be." That was my line. And it kept people off my back. And of course, one of the ways of experiencing emotion in groups is not just in experiential groups, it's also in religious groups. Mm-hmm. And I'd had quite a strong religious upbringing. I trained eventually after a degree in social anthropology and theology at Cambridge. I trained in teaching and survived a year in a school, which convinced me that the best education did not take place in a school and couldn't. And I then went to work in a social education project, which was based at the cathedral at Coventry. Now, Coventry was particularly interesting. Because it had been the first city in the UK to be firestorm bombed by the Luftwaffe, after the war, it developed very strong links with cities in Germany, both in East and West Germany, like Dresden, that had also been bombed. And in the days of the Cold War, we had a good number of visitors from East German churches who came at enormous risk to themselves. With some token agreement from their communist minders, who often came with them. So they were very frightened about what might be said in public. And I started to learn a lot, really, in private conversations with them about the costs of totalitarian regimes, how people survive, but also the advantages of working in a totalitarian regime. Because you learn how to survive shrunk inside your skin. You develop an inner core. Mm-hmm. And how people talked about that inner core, I thought was inspiring. Mm-hmm. And it inspired me eventually to train for the priesthood in the Church of England, which is what I did, thinking what we've done at Coventry could be done at the local level. It couldn't.
No,
I trained to be a priest, I trained in pastoral work. Obviously, I had to do preaching and run Sunday services. I engaged in what colloquially gets described as the hatching, matching, and dispatching processes of the rituals of christening, marriage, and funerals. And it was a role in which I was allowed into people's lives at very intimate moments.
Yeah.
And to invent some kind of ritual to enhance the moment. So on the one hand, I was loving the work, but the work didn't love me. And it was really tough. I had three children at the time, a wife and three children, and the institution expected you to turn up at 6:30 or 7:00 in the morning, which, if you're a solo person, single, or in a monastery, works very well. It doesn't, because your kids want songs and stories at that hour in the morning.
Yeah.
And I got myself into a certain amount of trouble because I was expected to be explicit about religion to everybody I met, whereas I thought the most effective work was to be implicit about it, to represent a role that was ambiguous, and to let people to imagine what it is that you represented, which was an aspect of them.
Yes.
But I'm afraid my membership of the church didn't last. I think I lasted 19 months before the row with my boss got too difficult. And I always say now that when people ask me why I left, I say it problems with management of one sort or another. It wasn't for me. I've taken a lot from it. And the role of the chaplain is a very rich one and translates very well into certain aspects of psychoanalytic engagement with individuals and organizations. So that's a short version of a long story.
Yeah. There are links, though, aren't there, between strong links between group relations thinking and church institutions, a way of understanding role in particular, authority.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I mean, when I was at theological college, rather than do a master's, I persuaded them to, and I found some funding, to work with Bruce Reed at the Grubb Institute for 2 years.
Yeah,
and it was an exploration of an application of group relations work to church communities called the use of power and authority in the local church. And along the way, he took me through his thinking of the sociology and psychoanalysis of groups and communities. I still have the notes. I mean, he was an extraordinary man. And he also told me about some of the engagements he was working in, not least some of his work in Northern Ireland with people across the violent divides of the Troubles. And I had some engagement for our family in Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. So I had a lot of affinity for that struggle. And at Coventry Cathedral, we'd had a number of meetings with representatives from different sides of the Troubles and from the army and the military in Ireland. We had a number of dialogues really about differences. And people being able to speak their truth across violent boundaries.
You've done some interesting work, Richard. Thank you for sharing that. We're coming to an end. What are your reflections from your life's experience on what it means to live a good life and what it takes to build a good society?
I think the first one, the first one is how important it is to be playful, to play with ideas, to play with people, to withhold, if you can, some of the sadistic elements of teasing, but not completely, and to let other people tease you for your silly and repetitive use of words and theories and ideas, and to get real, really, with people. It's far more important than anything else. Not just personally, which is obviously applies, and in our friendship, Simon, as you know, but also in clinical work, and to be able to laugh uproariously at somebody's folly, and it doesn't matter if it's the analysts or the patient. The same in organizations. The second is just to see if you can find innovative ways all the time to think about how old theories and old ideas can be put into a new context, mm-hmm. which makes them real and alive to what people are struggling with. I think working with people in hospitals in the early part of my career, and just presenting yourself at the end of a bed where someone strung up with a leg and plaster, and say, "Just my God, what the hell happened to you?" You know, and you've immediately got the potential for a contact.
Yes.
So that's what I would say.
So be playful and be innovative with ideas. Richard, it's been lovely talking with you. Thank you very much for sharing your thinking, and go well.
Thank you for the invitation.